on top of Mac's dugout, causing the roof to cave in. The startled lieutenant jumped up, pushing boards and soil aside, like a turtle rearing up out of a pile of debris. "You ruined my foxhole," Mac complained. George apologized, but I had to bite my lip to keep from laughing. The other men smirked and grinned. We never heard any more from Mac about charging the Japanese line with his K-bar and .45 caliber pistol. That enemy shelling had one beneficial result. It dissolved his bravado. We got our position squared away for the night and ate some K-rations, as well as one could with a stomach tied in knots. More details reached us about the loss of Nice, Westbrook, and others killed and wounded. We regretted any American casualties, but when they were close friends, it was terribly depressing. They were just the first of what was to grow into a long, tragic list before we would come out of combat 50 hellish days later. Before dark, we learned there would be a big attack the next morning all along the U.S. line, with the heavy Japanese fire poured onto us. As we moved into that line, we dreaded the prospect of making a push. An NCO told us that our objective was to reach the Asadogawa, a stream about 1,500 yards south of us that stretched inland and eastward to an area near the village of Dekeshi. Rain ushered in a gloomy dawn. We were apprehensive but hopeful. There was some small arms fire along the line, and a few shells passed back and forth during early morning. The rain slackened temporarily, and we ate some K-rations. On the folding pocket-sized tripod issued to us, I heated up a canteen cup of coffee with a Sterno tablet. I had to hover over it to keep the rain from drowning it out. As the seconds ticked slowly toward 0900, our artillery and ship's guns increased their rate of fire. The rain poured down, and the Japanese took up the challenge from our artillery. They started throwing more shells our way, many of which passed over us and exploded far to our rear, where our own artillery wasn't placed. Finally, we received orders to open fire with our mortars. Our shells exploded along a defilade to our front. Our machine guns opened up in earnest. Our artillery, ship's guns, and 81mm mortars increased the tempo to an awesome rate as the time for the attack approached. The shells whistled, whined, and rumbled overhead, ours bursting out in front of the ridge, and the enemy's exploding in our area into the rear. The noise increased all along the line. Rain fell in torrents, and the soil became muddy and slippery wherever we hurried around the gun pit to break out and stack our ammo. I looked at my watch. It was 0900. I gulped and prayed for my buddies in the rifle platoons. "Mortar, cease firing and stand by." We were ready to fire or to take up the mortars at a moment's notice and move forward. Some of our riflemen moved past the crest of the ridge to attack. Noise that had been loud now grew into a deafening bedlam. The riflemen hardly got out of their foxholes when a storm of enemy fire from our front and left flank force them back. The same thing was happening to the battalions on our right and left. The sound of the many machine guns became one incredible rattle against a thundering and booming artillery. Rifles popped everywhere along the line, while Japanese slugs snapped over the low ridge behind which we lay. We fired some white phosphorus shells to screen our withdrawing troops. Just as we heard, "Cease firing!" a Marine came running through the mud on the slope to our right, yelling, "The guys pulling back need a stretcher team for mortars." Three other mortarmen and I took off on the double after the messenger. With bullets snapping and popping overhead, we ran along for about 40 yards, keeping just below the crest of the ridge. We came to a road cut through the ridge about 8 feet below the crest. An officer told us to stand behind him until we were ordered to go out and bring in the casualty. This was the exact spot where Nice and Westbrook had been machine gunned the day before. Japanese bullets were zipping and swishing through the cut like hail pouring through an open window. A couple of Company K rifle squads were running back toward us from the abortive attack. They rushed along the road in small groups and turned right and left as soon as they got through the cut to get out of the line of fire. Incredibly, none got hit by the thick fire coming through the cut. I knew most of them well, although some of the new men not as well as the veterans. They all wore wild-eyed, shocked expressions that showed only too vividly they were men who had barely escaped Chance's strange arithmetic. They clung to their M1s, BARs, and Tommy guns and slumped to the mud to pant for breath before moving behind the ridge toward their former foxholes. The torrential rain made it all seem so much more unbelievable and terrible. I hoped fervently that we wouldn't have to step out into that road to pick up a casualty. I felt ashamed for thinking this, but I knew full well that if I were lying out there wounded, my fellow Marines wouldn't leave me. But I didn't see how anyone could go out and get back now that the volume of fire was so intense. Since most of our attacking troops had fallen back, the Japanese could concentrate their fire on the stretcher teams as I had seen them do at Peleliu. They showed medical personnel no mercy. Our company gunnery sergeant, Hank Boyce, was the last man through the cut. He made a quick check of the men and announced, to my immense relief, that everyone had made it back. Casualties had been brought back farther down the line, where the machine gun fire hadn't been as heavy. Boyes was amazing. He had dashed out to the men pinned down in front of the ridge, where he threw smoke grenades to shield them from the Japanese fire. He returned with a hole shot through his dungaree cap. He wasn't wearing his helmet, and another through his pants leg. He had been hit in the leg with fragments from a Japanese knee mortar shell, but refused to turn in. The officer told us we wouldn't be needed as stretcher bearers, and to return to our posts. As we took off on the double to the gun pits, the shells kept up their heavy traffic back and forth, but the bullets began to slacken off somewhat, with all our men by then under cover of the ridge. I jumped into the gun pit, and my temporary replacement hurried back to his hole. We crouched in our foxholes in the pouring rain, cursing the Japanese, the shells, and the weather. The enemy gunners poured fire into our company area to discourage another attack. Word came down the line that all attacking Marine units had suffered considerable casualties, so we would remain inactive until the next day. That suited us fine. The Japanese shelling continued viciously for some time. We all felt depressed about the failure of the attack, and we still didn't know how many friends we had lost, an uncertainty that always bore down on every man after an attack or firefight. From the gun pit, which contained several inches of water, we looked out on a gloomy scene. The rain had settled into a steady pelting that promised much misery. Across the muddy fields, we saw our soaked comrades crouching forlornly in their muddy holes and ducking, as we did, each time a shell roared over. This was my first taste of mud in combat, and it was more detestable than I had ever imagined. Mud in camp on Pavuvu was a nuisance. Mud on maneuvers was an inconvenience. But mud on the battlefield was misery beyond description. I had seen photographs of World War I troops in the mud, the men grinning, of course, if the picture was posed. If not posed, the faces always wore a peculiarly forlorn, disgusted expression, an expression I now understood. The air was chilly and clammy, but I thanked God we weren't experiencing this misery in Europe, where the foxholes were biting cold as well as wet. The shelling finally subsided, and things got fairly quiet in our area. We squatted thankfully in our holes and grumbled about the rain. The humid air hung heavily with the chemical odor of exploded shells. Shortly to our left rear, we saw a Marine stretcher team bringing a casualty back through the rain. Instead of turning left behind the ridge we were on, or right behind the one further across the field, the team headed straight back between the two low ridges. This was a mistake, because we knew the Japanese could still fire on that area. As the stretcher team approached the cover of some trees, Japanese riflemen to our left front opened up on them. We saw bullets kicking up mud and splashing in the puddles of water around the team. The four stretcher bearers hurried across the slippery field, but they couldn't go faster than a rapid walk, or the casualty might fall off the stretcher. We requested permission to fire 60mm phosphorus shells as a smoke screen. We were too far away to throw smoke grenades to cover the stretcher team. Permission was denied. We weren't allowed to fire across our company front because of the possibility of hitting unseen friendly troops. Thus, we watched helplessly as the four stretcher bearers struggled across the muddy field with bullets falling all around them. It was one of those terribly pathetic, heart-rending sights that seemed to rule in combat. Men struggling to save a wounded comrade, the enemy firing at them as fast as they could, and the rest of us utterly powerless to give any aid. To witness such a scene was worse than personal danger. It was absolute agony. To lighten their loads, the four carriers had put all of their personal equipment aside, except for a rifle or carbine over their shoulder. Each held a handle of the stretcher in one hand and stretched out the other arm for balance. Their shoulders were stooped with the weight of the stretcher. Four helmeted heads hung low, like four beasts of burden being flogged. Soaked with rain and spattered with mud, the dark green dungarees hung forlornly on the men. The casualty lay inert on the narrow canvas stretcher, his life in the hands of the struggling four. To our dismay, the two carriers in the rear got hit by a burst of fire. Each loosened his grip on the stretcher. Their knees buckled, and they fell over backwards onto the muddy ground. The stretcher pitched onto the deck. A gasp went up from the men around me, but it turned almost immediately into roars of relief. The two Marines at the other end of the stretcher threw it down, spun around, and grabbed the stretcher casualty between them. Then, each supported a wounded carrier with his other arm. As we cheered, all five assisted one another and limped and hobbled into the cover of the bushes, bullets still kicking up mud all around them. I felt relief and elation over their escape, matched only by a deepened hatred for the Japanese. Before nightfall, we received information that Company K would push again the next day. As the rain slowly diminished and then ceased, we made our grim preparations. While receiving extra ammo, rations, and water, I saw our company officers and NCOs gathering nearby. They stood or squatted around the CO, talking quietly. Our company commander was obviously in charge, giving orders and answering questions. The senior NCOs and the veteran officers stood by with serious, sometimes worried expressions as they listened. Those of us in the ranks watched their familiar faces carefully for signs of what was in store for us. The faces of the replacement lieutenants reflected a different mood. They showed enthusiastic, animated expressions with eyebrows raised in eager anticipation of seeing the thing through, like a successful field problem at OCS in Quantico. They were very conscientious and determined to do their best or die in the effort. To me, those young officers appeared almost tragic in their naive innocence and ignorance of what lay ahead for us all. The new officers bore a heavy burden. Not only were they going into combat with all its terrors and unknowns for the first time, conditions even the best of training couldn't possibly duplicate, but they were untried officers. Combat was the acid test. Faced with heavy responsibilities and placed in a position of leadership amid hardened, seasoned Marine combat veterans in a proud, elite division like the 1st was a difficult situation and a terrific challenge for any young lieutenant. No one I knew in the ranks envied them in the least. During the course of the long fighting on Okinawa, Unlike at Peleliu, we got numerous replacement lieutenants. They were wounded or killed with such regularity that we rarely knew anything about them other than a code name and saw them on their feet only once or twice. We expected heavy losses of enlisted men in combat, but our officers got hit so soon and so often that it seemed to me the position of second lieutenant in a rifle company had been made obsolete by modern warfare. After the CO dismissed the junior officers, they returned to their respective platoons and briefed the troops about the impending push. Mac was crisp and efficient in his orders to Bergen and the rest of the mortar section NCOs. In turn, they told us what to prepare for. It was good to see Mac divested of his cockiness. We would get maximum support from heavy artillery and other weapons. Casualties would be given swift aid. So we prepared our equipment and waited nervously. A friend came over from one of the rifle platoons that was to be in the next day's assault. We sat near the gun pit on our helmets in the mud and had a long talk. I lit my pipe, and he a cigarette. Things were quiet in the area, so we were undisturbed for some time. He poured out his heart. He had come to me because of our friendship and because I was a veteran. He told me he was terribly afraid about the impending attack. I said everybody was. But I knew he would be in a more vulnerable position than some of us because his platoon was in the assault. I did my best to cheer him up. He was so appalled and depressed by the fighting of the previous day that he had concluded he couldn't possibly survive the next day. He confided his innermost thoughts and secrets about his parents and a girl back home whom he was going to marry after the war. The poor guy wasn't just afraid of death or injury. The idea that he might never return to those he loved so much had him in a state of near desperation. I remembered how Lieutenant Hillbilly Jones had comforted and helped me through the first shock of Peleliu, and I tried to do the same for my friend. Finally, he seemed somewhat relieved, or resigned to his fate, whatever it might be. We got up and shook hands. He thanked me for our friendship, then walked slowly back to his foxhole. There was nothing unique in the conversation. Thousands like it occurred every day among infantrymen scheduled to enter the chaos and inferno of an attack. But it illustrates the value of camaraderie among men facing constant hardship and frequent danger. Friendship was the only comfort a man had. It seems strange how men occupied themselves after all weapons and gear had been squared away for an impending attack. We had learned in boot camp that no pack strap should be left with loose ends dangling. Any such loose straps on a Marine's pack were called Irish pennants. Why Irish, I never knew. And resulted in disciplinary action or a blast from the drill instructor. So, from pure habit, I suppose, we carefully rolled up the loose straps and shaped up our packs. There was always a bit of cleaning and touching up to be done on one's weapon, with the toothbrush most of us carried for that purpose. A man could always straighten up his lacings on his leggings, too. With such trivia, doomed men busily occupied themselves, as though when they got up and moved forward out of their foxholes, it would be to an inspection, rather than to oblivion. We were partially successful with our attack on 3 May. The knockout of the Japanese heavy machine gun by our mortars the previous day helped our companies advance to the next low ridgeline. But we couldn't hold the hills. Heavy enemy machine gun and mortar fire drove us back about 100 yards. Thus, we gained about 300 yards for the entire day. We moved into a quiet area back of the front lines well before dark. Word came that because of heavy casualties over the past 2 days fighting, Company K would go into battalion reserve for a while. We dug in around the battalion aid station for its defense. Our casualties were still coming back from the afternoon's action as we moved into position. Much to my joy, I saw the friend with whom I'd had the conversation the night before. He wore a triumphant look of satisfaction, shook hands with me heartily, and grinned as a stretcher team carried him by with a bloody bandage on his foot. God or chance, depending on one's faith, had spared his life and lifted his burden of further fear and terror in combat by awarding him a $1 million wound. He had done his duty, and the war was over for him. He was in pain, but he was lucky. Many others hadn't been as lucky the last couple of days. Counterattack. We settled into our holes for the night, feeling more at ease off the line and in a quiet area. My foxhole partner had the first watch, so I dropped off to sleep, confident that we would have a fairly quiet night. I hadn't slept long before he woke me with, "Sledgehammer, wake up! The Nips are up to something!" Startled, I awoke and instinctively unholstered my .45 automatic. I heard a stern order from an NCO. "Stand by for a ram, you guys! 100% alert!" I heard heavy artillery and small arms firing up on the line. It seemed to come mostly from the area beyond our division's left flank, where army troops were located. The firing directly forward had increased too. Our artillery shells swished overhead in incredible numbers. It wasn't just the usual harassing fire against the Japanese. There was too much of it for that. "What's the dope?" I asked nervously. "Beats me," said my buddy. "But something sure the hell's going on up on the line. Nip's probably pulling a counterattack." From the increasing fire, enemy as well as friendly, it was obvious something big was happening. As we waited in our holes, hoping to get word about what was going on, heavy machine gun and mortar fire broke out, abruptly some distance to our right, to the rear of where the 1st Marine line reached the sea. From our little mound, we saw streams of American machine gun tracers darting straight out to sea under the eerie light of 60mm mortar flares. That could only mean one thing. The enemy was staging an amphibious attack, trying to come ashore behind the right flank of the 1st Marines, which was the right-hand regiment of the 1st Marine Division's line. The Nips must be pulling a counter-landing, and the 1st Marines giving them hell, someone said tensely. Could our comrades in the 1st Marine Regiment stop that attack? That was the question on everyone's mind. But one man said confidently in a low voice, "The 1st Marines will tear their ass up, betcha." We hoped he was right. With no more than we knew, it was clear that if the Japanese got ashore on our right flank and counterattacked heavily on our left and front, our entire division might be isolated. We sat and listened apprehensively in the darkness. As if things didn't seem grim enough, the next order came along. "Stand by for possible Jap paratroop attack. All hands turn to. Keep your eyes open." My blood felt like ice water throughout my body, and I shuddered. We weren't afraid of Japanese paratroopers as such. They couldn't be any tougher to deal with than veteran Japanese infantry. But the fear of being cut off from other U.S. troops by having the enemy land behind us filled us with dread. Most nights on Peleliu, we had to keep a sharp lookout to front, rear, right, and left. But that night on Okinawa, we had to scan even the dark sky for signs of parachutes. We lived constantly with the fear of death or maiming from wounds. But the possibility of being surrounded by the enemy and wounded beyond the point of being able to defend myself chilled my soul. They were notorious for their brutality. A couple of Japanese planes flew over during the night. We recognized the sound of the engines, and I experienced a dread I had never known before. But they passed on without dropping parachutists. They were bombers or fighters on their way to attack our ships lying offshore. The Japanese and American artillery fired to our left front rumbled and roared on and on with frightening intensity, drowning out the rattle of machine guns and rifles. To our right, elements of the 1st Marine Regiment kept up their small arms and mortar fire out to sea for quite some time. We heard scattered rifle fire far to our rear. This was disturbing. But some optimists said it was probably nothing more than trigger-happy, rear echelon guys firing at shadows. Rumors passed that some enemy soldiers had broken through the army's line on our left. It was a long night made worse by the uncertainty and confusion around us. I suffered extremely mixed emotions. Glad on the one hand to be out of the fighting, but anxious for those Americans catching the fury of the enemy's attack. At first light, we heard Japanese planes attacking our ships and saw the fleet throwing up anti-aircraft fire. Despite the aerial attack, the ship's big guns began heavy firing against the Japanese on land. Toward our right and rear, the firing of our infantry units slackened. We learned that radio messages indicated the 1st Marines had slaughtered hundreds of Japanese in the water when they tried a landing behind our division's flank. The sound of scattered firing told us some enemy had slipped ashore, but the major threat was over. Our artillery increased its support fire to our front, and we were told that our division would attack during the day. We would remain in position, however, an order we found most agreeable. Word came that army troops on our left had held off the main Japanese attack, but things were still grim in that area. Some enemy had gotten through, and others were still attacking. While 3-5 remained in reserve, the 1st Marine Division began its attack to our front, and we heard that the opposition was ferocious. We received orders to be on the lookout for any enemy that might have slipped around the division's flank during the night. There were none. There was a massive enemy air attack against our fleet at this time. We saw a kamikaze fly through a thick curtain of flak and crash dive into a cruiser. A huge white smoke ring rose thousands of feet into the air. We heard shortly that it was the cruiser USS Birmingham that had suffered considerable damage and loss of life among her crew.
The Japanese counterattack of the 3rd to the 4th of May was a major effort aimed at confusing the American battle plan by isolating and destroying the 1st Marine Division. The Japanese made a night amphibious landing of several hundred men on the east coast behind the 7th Infantry Division. Coordinated with that landing was another on the west coast behind the 1st Marine Division. The Japanese plan called for the two elements to move inland, join up, and create confusion to the rear while the main counterattack hit the American center. The Japanese 24th Infantry Division concentrated its frontal attack on the boundary between the American Army's 7th and 77th Infantry Divisions. The enemy planned to send a separate brigade through the gap in the American lines created by the 24th Division's attack, swing it to the left behind the 1st Marine Division, and hit the Marines as the Japanese 62nd Infantry Division attacked the 1st Marine Division's front. If the plan succeeded, the enemy would isolate and destroy the 1st Marine Division. It failed when the two American Army divisions stopped the frontal assault, except for a few minor penetrations, with more than 6,000 Japanese dead counted. At the same time, the 1st Marines, on the right of the 1st Marine Division, discovered the enemy landing on the west coast. They killed over 300 enemy in the water and on the beach.
Chapter 11 Of Shock and Shells. Heavy rain began on 6 May and lasted through 8 May, a preview of the nightmare of mud we would endure from the end of the second week of May until the end of the month. Our division had reached the banks of the Asatogawa at a cost of 1,409 casualties, killed and wounded. I knew losses had been heavy during the first week of May because of the large number of casualties I saw in just the small area we were operating in. On 8 May, Nazi Germany surrendered unconditionally. We were told this momentous news, but considering our own peril and misery, no one cared much. "So what?" was typical of the remarks I heard around me. We were resigned only to the fact that the Japanese would fight to total extinction on Okinawa, as they had elsewhere, and that Japan would have to be invaded with the same gruesome prospects. Nazi Germany might as well have been on the moon. The main thing that impressed us about VE Day was a terrific, thundering artillery and naval gunfire barrage that went swishing, roaring, and rumbling toward the Japanese. I thought it was in preparation for the next day's attack. Years later, I read that the barrage had been fired on enemy targets at noon for its destructive effect on them, but also as a salute to VE Day. The 6th Marine Division moved into the line on our right, and our division shifted toward the left somewhat. This put us in the center of the American front. As we crouched in our muddy foxholes in the cold rain, the arrival of the 6th Marine Division, plus the massive artillery barrage, did more for our morale than news about Europe. The 5th Marines approached the village of Dekeshi and ran into a strong enemy defense system in an area known as the Awacha Pocket. Talk was that we were approaching the main Japanese defense line, the Shuri Line. But Awacha and Dekeshi confronted us before we reached the main ridges of the Shuri Line. When our battalion dug in front of Awacha, our mortars were emplaced on the slope of a little rise about 75 yards behind the front line. The torrents of rain were causing us other problems besides chilly misery. Our tanks couldn't move up to support us. Amtraks had to bring a lot of supplies because the jeeps and trailers bogged down in the soft soil. Ammunition, boxes of rations, and 5-gallon cans of water were brought up as close to us as possible. But because of the mud along a shallow draw that ran to the rear of the mortar section, all supplies were piled about 50 yards away in a supply dump on the other side of the draw. Working parties went off to carry the supplies from the dump across the draw to the rifle platoons in the mortar section. Carrying ammo and rations was something the Varens had done plenty of times before. With the others, I had struggled up and down Peleliu's unbelievably rugged, rocky terrain in the suffocating heat, carrying ammo, rations, and water. Like carrying stretcher cases, it was exhausting work. But this was my first duty on a working party in deep mud, and it surpassed the drudgery of any working party I had ever experienced. All ammunition was heavy, of course, but some was easier to handle than others. We praised the manufacturers of hand grenade and belt and machine gun ammunition boxes. The former were wooden, with a nice rope handle on each side. The latter were metal and had a collapsible handle on top. But we cursed the dolts who made the wooden cases our 30-caliber rifle ammo came in. Each box contained 1,000 rounds of ammunition. It was heavy and had only a small notch cut into either end. This allowed only a fingertip grip by the 2 men usually needed to handle a single crate. We spent a great deal of time in combat carrying this heavy ammunition on our shoulders to places where it was needed. Spots often totally inaccessible to all types of vehicles, and breaking it out of the packages and crates. On Okinawa, this was often done under enemy fire, in driving rain, and through knee-deep mud for hours on end. Such activity drove the infantrymen, weary from the mental and physical stress of combat, almost to the brink of physical collapse. A great number of books and films about the war ignored this grueling facet of the infantryman's war. They gave the impression that ammunition was always up there when needed. Maybe my outfit just happened to get a particularly bad dose of carrying ammo into position on Peleliu because of the heat and rugged terrain, and on Okinawa because of the deep mud. But the work was something none of us would forget. It was exhausting, demoralizing, and seemingly unending. In this first position before Awacha, those of us detailed to the working parties had made a couple of trips across the shallow draw when a Nambu light machine gun opened up from a position to our left. I was about midway across the draw, in no particular hurry, when the Japanese gunner fired his first bursts down the draw. I took off at a run, slipping and sliding on the mud, to the protected area where the supply dump was placed. Slugs snapped viciously around me. The men with me also were lucky as we dove for the protection of a knoll beside the supplies. The enemy machine gunner was well concealed up the draw to our left and had a clear field of fire anytime anyone crossed where we were. We were bound to lose men to that Nambu if we kept moving back and forth. Yet we had to get the ammo distributed for the coming attack. We looked across the draw toward the mortar section and saw Redifer throw out a phosphorus grenade to give us smokescreen protection when we came back across. He threw several more grenades, which went off with a muffled bump and a flash. Thick clouds of white smoke billowed forth and hung almost immobile in the heavy, misty air. I grabbed a metal box of 60mm mortar ammo in each hand. Each of the other men also picked up a load. We prepared to cross. The Nambu kept firing down the smoke-covered draw. I was reluctant to go, as were the others. But we could see Redifer standing out in the draw, throwing more phosphorus grenades to hide us. I felt like a coward. My buddies must have felt the same way as we glanced anxiously at each other. Someone said resignedly, "Let's go. On the double. And keep your 5-pace interval." We dashed into the smoky, murky air. I lowered my head and gritted my teeth as the machine gun slug snapped and zipped around us. I expected to get hit. So did the others. I wasn't being brave, but Redifer was, and I would rather take my chances than be yellow in the face of his risks to screen us. If he got hit while I was cringing in safety, I knew it would haunt me the rest of my life. That is, if I lived much longer, which seemed more unlikely every day. The smoke hit us from the gunner, but he kept firing intermittent bursts down the draw to prevent our crossing. Slugs popped and snapped, but we made it across. We rushed behind the knoll and flung the heavy ammo boxes down on the mud. We thanked Redifer, but he seemed more concerned with solving the problem at hand than talking. Boy, that Nip's got the best trained trigger finger I ever heard. "Listen to them short bursts he gets off," a buddy said. We panted and listened to the machine gun half in terror and half in admiration of the Japanese gunner's skill. He continued to fire across the rear of our position. Each burst was 2 or 3 rounds and spaced tat-tat, tat-tat-tat, tat-tat. Just then, we heard the engine of a tank some distance across the draw. Without a word, Redifer sped across the draw toward the sound. He got across safely. We could see him dimly through the drifting smoke as he contacted the tankers. Shortly, we saw him backing toward us slowly, giving the tankers hand signals as he directed the big Sherman across the draw. The Nambu kept firing blindly through the smoke as we watched Redifer anxiously. He seemed unhurried and reached us safely with the tank. The tankers had agreed to act as a shield for us in our hazardous crossing. With several of us crouching in the welcome protection it afforded us, the tank moved back and forth across the draw, always between us and the enemy machine gun. We loaded up on ammo and moved slowly across the machine gun swept draw, hugging the side of the tank like chicks beside a mother hen. We kept this up until all the ammo was brought safely across. The troops often expressed the opinion that whether an enlisted man was or wasn't recommended for a decoration for outstanding conduct in combat depended primarily on who saw him perform the deed. This certainly was true in the case of Redifer and what he had done to get the ammunition across the draw. I had seen other men awarded decorations for less, but Redifer was not so fortunate as to receive the official praise he deserved. Just the opposite happened. As we finished the chore of moving the ammo across the draw, a certain first lieutenant, who by some unlucky chance had been assigned to Company K after Peleliu, came up. We called him simply Shadow. A tall, skinny man. He was the sloppiest Marine, officer or enlisted, I ever saw. His dungarees hung on him like old, discarded clothes on a scarecrow. His web pistol belt was wrapped around his waist like a loose sash on a dressing gown. His map case flopped around. And every pack strap dangled more Irish pennants than any new recruit had in boot camp. Shadow never wore canvas leggings when I saw him. His trouser legs were rolled up unevenly above his skinny ankles. He didn't fit his camouflaged cloth helmet covered tightly over his helmet like most Marines. It sagged to one side, like some big stocking cap. For some reason, he frequently carried his helmet upside down in his left hand, clutched against his side like a football. On his head, he wore a green cloth fatigue cap like the rest of us wore under our helmets. But his cap was torn across the top so that his dark hair protruded like straw through a scarecrow's hat. Shadow's disposition was worse than his appearance. Moody, ill-tempered, and highly excitable, he cursed the veteran enlisted men worse than most DIs did recruits in boot camp. When he was displeased with a Marine about something, he didn't reprimand the man the way our other officers did. He threw a tantrum. He would grab his cap by the bill, fling it onto the muddy deck, stamp his feet, and curse everyone in sight. The veteran sergeant who accompanied Shadow would stand silently by during these temper displays, torn between a compulsion to reprimand us, if it seemed his duty to do so, and embarrassment and disapproval over his officer's childish behavior. In all fairness, I don't know how competent an officer Shadow was considered to be by his superiors. Needless to say, he wasn't highly regarded in the ranks, simply on the basis of his lack of self-control. But he was brave. I'll give him that. Shadow pitched a fit in reaction to what Redifer had done in facilitating our ammo transportation across the draw. It was just the first of many such performances I was to witness, and they never ceased to amaze as well as disgust me. He went to Redifer and unleashed such a verbal assault against him that anyone who didn't know better would have assumed that Redifer was a coward who had deserted his post in the face of the enemy instead of having just performed a brave act. Shadow yelled, gesticulated, and cursed Redifer for exposing himself unnecessarily to enemy fire when he was throwing the smoke grenades into the draw and when he went to contact the tank. Redifer took it quietly, but he was obviously dismayed. We looked on in disbelief, having expected Shadow to praise the man for showing bravery and initiative under fire. But here was this ranting, raving officer actually cursing and berating a man for doing something any other officer would have considered a meritorious act. It was so incredibly illogical that we couldn't believe it. Finally, having vented his rage on a Marine who rightfully deserved praise, Shadow strode off grumbling and cursing the individual and collective stupidity of enlisted men. Redifer didn't say anything. He just looked off into the distance. We growled mightily, though. As midday approached on 9 May, everyone was tense about the coming attack. Ammunition had been issued, men had squared away their gear, and had done their last-minute duties, adjusting cartridge belts, pack straps, leggings, and leather rifle slings. All those forlorn little gestures of no value that release tension in the face of impending terror. We had previously registered our mortars on selected targets and had stacked HE and phosphorus shells off the mud on pieces of boxes for quick access. The ground, having dried sufficiently for our tanks to maneuver, several stood by with engines idling, hatches open, and the tankers waiting. Waiting like everyone else. War was mostly waiting. The men around me sat silently with drawn faces. Some replacements had come into the company to make up for our earlier losses. These new men looked more confused than afraid. The big guns had fired periodically during the morning, but then had died away. There wasn't much noise as we waited for the pre-attack bombardment to begin. Then, the pre-assault bombardment commenced. The big shells swished overhead as each battery of our artillery and each ship's guns began to shell the Japanese Owacha defenses ahead of us. At first, we could identify each type of shell, 75mm, 105mm, and 155mm artillery, along with the 5-inch ship's guns, as it added to the storm of steel. We saw our planes overhead, Corsairs and dive bombers. Airstrikes began as the planes dove, firing rockets, dropping bombs, and strafing to our front. The firing thundered and rumbled until finally, even the experienced ears of the veterans could distinguish nothing, only that we were glad that all that stuff was ours. Enemy artillery and mortar shells began coming in as the Japanese tried to disrupt the attack. The replacements looked utterly bewildered amid the bedlam. I remembered my first day in combat and sympathized with them. The sheer massiveness of the pre-attack bombardment was an awesome and frightening thing to witness as a veteran, let alone as a new replacement. Soon the order came. Mortar section, stand by. We took directions from Bergen, who was up on the observation post to spot targets and direct our fire. Although our 60mm shells were small compared to the huge shells rushing overhead, we could fire close in to the company front, where bigger mortars and the artillery couldn't shoot without endangering our own people. This closeness made it doubly critical that we fire skillfully and avoid short rounds. We had fired only a few rounds when Snafu began cursing the mud. With each round, the recoil pushed the mortar's base plate against the soft soil in the gun pit, and he had trouble reciting the leveling bubbles to retain proper alignment of the gun on the aiming stake. After we completed the first fire mission, we quickly moved the gun a little to one side of the pit onto a harder surface and resighted it. At Peleliu, we often had to hold the base plate as well as the bipod feet onto the coral rock to prevent the recoil from making the base plate bounce aside, knocking the mortar's alignment out too far. On Okinawa's wet clay soil, just the opposite happened. The recoil drove the base plate into the ground with each round we fired. This problem got worse as the rains increased during May, and the ground became softer and softer. The order came to secure the guns and to stand by. The airstrike ended, and the artillery and ship's guns slacked off. The tanks and our riflemen moved out as tank infantry teams, and we waited tensely. Things went well for a couple of hundred yards during this attack made by 3-5 and 3-7 before heavy fire from Japanese on the left flank stopped the attack. Our OP, observation post, ordered us to fire smoke because heavy enemy fire was coming from our left. We fired phosphorus rapidly to screen the men from the enemy observers. Our position got a heavy dose of Japanese 90mm mortar counter battery fire. We had a difficult time keeping up our firing with those big 90mm shells crashing around us. Shell fragments whined through the air, and the big shells slung mud around. But we had to keep up our fire. The riflemen were catching hail from the flank and had to be supported. Our artillery began firing again at the enemy positions to our left to aid the harassed riflemen. We always knew when we were inflicting losses on the Japanese with our 60mm mortars by the amount of counter-battery mortar and artillery fire they threw back at us. If we weren't doing them any damage, they usually ignored us unless they thought they could inflict a lot of casualties. If the Japanese counter-battery fire was a real indicator of our effectiveness in causing them casualties, we were satisfyingly effective during the Okinawa campaign. During the attack of 9 May against Owacha, Company K suffered heavy losses. It was the same tragic sight of bloody, dazed, and wounded men benumbed with shock, being carried or walking to the aid station in the rear. There also were the dead. and the usual anxious inquiries about friends. We were all glad when the word came that 3-5 would move into reserve for the 7th Marines, for a couple of days it turned out. The 7th Marines were fighting to our right against Dakeshi Ridge. The battle against the Watcher raged on to our left. We dug in for the night in the wet ground. Our mortars weren't set up. We were to act as riflemen and to keep watch across an open, sloping valley. Above us, the other two mortar squads dug in two parallel lines about 20 feet apart and perpendicular to the line of the crest of the embankment above us. Water and rations were issued and mail brought to us. Mail usually was a big morale booster, but not for me that time. There was a chilly, drizzling rain off and on. We were weary, and my spirits weren't the best. I sat in my helmet in the mud and read a letter from my parents. It brought news that Deacon, my beloved spaniel, had been hit by an automobile and dragged himself home and had died in my father's arms. He had been my constant companion during the several years before I had left home for college. There, with the sound of heavy firing up ahead and the sufferings and deaths of thousands of men going on nearby, big tears rolled down my cheeks because Deacon was dead. During the remainder of the night, the sound of firing toward Dakeshi Ridge indicated that the 7th Marines were having a lot of trouble trying to push the Japanese off the ridge. Just before dawn, we could hear heavy firing off to our left front where 1-5 and 2-5 were fighting around the Awacha pocket. "Stand by, you guys, and be prepared to move out," came the order from an NCO on the embankment above us. "What's the hot dope?" a mortarman asked. "Don't know, except the Nips are counterattacking on the 5th Marines front, and the battalion, 3-5, is on standby to go up and help stop them." We greeted the news with an understandable lack of enthusiasm. We were still tired and tense from the punishment the battalion took at Awacha the day before. What's more, we didn't relish moving anywhere in the darkness. But we squared away our gear, chewed gum nervously, or gnawed on ration biscuits. The sound of firing rose and fell to our left front as we waited and wondered. Finally, during the misty gray light of early morning, the order came. "Okay, you guys, let's go." We picked up our loads and moved toward the front lines. Other than occasional shells whining over in both directions, things were rather calm. Our column moved along a ridge just below the crest to the emplacements of the Marines who had been under attack. We found them assessing the damage they had done to the Japanese and caring for their own wounded. Some of the men told us the enemy had come into bayonet range before being repulsed. "But we tore their ass up, by God," one man said to me, as he pointed out about 40 Japanese corpses sprawled beyond the Marine foxholes. In the pale dawn, the air was misty and still smoky from phosphorus shells the enemy had fired to hide their approach. There was a big discussion in the ranks. Comments passed along to us from the Marines in place had it that somebody had seen a woman advancing with the attacking Japanese and that she was probably among the dead out there. We couldn't see her from our positions. Then word came. "About face, we're moving back." In short, our help wasn't needed, so we were to be deployed somewhere else. Back through the rain and the mud we went. All movements during most of May and early June were physically exhausting and utterly exasperating because of the mud. Typically, we moved in single file, 5 paces apart, slipping and sliding up and down muddy slopes and through boggy fields. When the column slowed or stopped, we tended to bunch up, and the NCOs and officers ordered sternly, "Keep your 5-pace interval. Don't bunch up." The ever-present danger of shells even far behind the lines, made it necessary that we stay strung out. However, sometimes it was so dark that in order not to get separated and lost, each man was ordered to hold on to the cartridge belt of the man in front of him. This made the going difficult over rough and muddy terrain. Often, if a man lost his footing and fell, several others went down with him, sprawling over each other in the mud. There were muffled curses and exasperated groans as they wearily disentangled themselves and regained their footing, groping about in the inky darkness to reform the column. As soon as we stopped, the order came, "Move out!" So the column always moved forward, but like an accordion or an inchworm, compressed, then strung out, stopping and starting. If a man put down his load for a brief respite, he was sure to hear, "Pick up your gear, we're moving out." So the load had to be hoisted onto shoulders again. But if you didn't put it down, chances were you missed an opportunity to rest for a few seconds, or even up to an hour, while the column halted up ahead for reasons usually unknown. To sit down on a rock or on a helmet when drunk with fatigue was like pressing a button to signal some NCO to shout, "On your feet, pick up your gear, we're moving out again." So the big decision in every man's mind at each pause in the column's forward progress was whether to drop his load and hope for a lengthy pause, or to stand there and support all the weight rather than putting it down and having to pick it up again right away. The column wound around and up and down the contours of terrain, which in May and early June was covered nearly always with slippery mud, varying in depth from a few inches to knee-deep. The rain was frequent and chilly. It varied from drizzles to wind-driven, slashing deluges that flooded our muddy footprints almost as soon as we made them. The helmet, of course, kept one's head dry, but a poncho was the only body protection we had. It was floppy and restricted movement greatly. We had no raincoats. So, rather than struggle over slippery terrain with our loads, encumbered further by a loose-fitting poncho, we just got soaking wet and shivered in misery. We tried to wisecrack and joke from time to time, but that always faded away as we grew more weary or closer to the front lines. That kind of movement over normal terrain or on roads would try any man's patience. But in Okinawa was mud. It drove us to a state of frustration and exasperation, bordering on rage. It can be appreciated only by someone who has experienced it. Most men finally came to the state where they just stood stoically immobile, with a resigned expression when halted and waited to move out. The cursing and outbursts of rage didn't seem to help, although no one was above it when goaded to the point of desperation and fatigue with halting and moving, slipping and sliding, and falling in the mud. Mud didn't just interfere with vehicles. It exhausted the man on foot who was expected to keep on where wheels or treaded vehicles couldn't move. At some point during our moves, our mortar section completely wiped out an enemy force that had held an elongated ridge for 3 days against repeated Marine infantry attacks supported by heavy artillery fire. Bergen was observing. He reasoned that there must have been a narrow gully running along the ridge that sheltered the Japanese from the artillery fire. He registered our three mortars so that one fired from right to left, another from left to right, and the third along the crest of the ridge. Thus, the Japanese in the gully couldn't escape. Lieutenant Mack ordered Bergen not to carry out the fire mission. He said we couldn't spare the ammo. Bergen, a three-campaign veteran and a skillful observer, called the company CP and asked if they could get us the ammo. The CP told him yes. Over the sound-powered phone, Bergen said, "On my command, fire." Mack was with us at the gun pits and ordered us not to fire. He told Bergen the same over the phone. Bergen told him to go to hell and yelled, "Mortar section, fire on my command. Commence firing." We fired, as Mac ranted and raved. When we finished firing, the company moved against the ridge. Not a shot was fired at our men. Bergen checked the target area and saw more than 50 freshly killed Japanese soldiers in a narrow ravine. All dead from wounds obviously caused by our mortar fire. The artillery shells had exploded in front of or to the rear of the Japanese, who were protected from them. Our 60mm mortar shells fell right into the ravine, however, because of their steeper trajectory. We had scored a significant success with the teamwork of our mortar section. The event illustrated the value of experience in a veteran like Bergen, compared with the poor judgment of a green lieutenant. The short period of rest in May helped us physically and mentally. Such periodic rests off the lines, lasting from a day to several days, enabled us to keep going. The rations were better. We could shave and clean up a bit using our helmets for a basin. Although we had to dig in because of long-range artillery or air raids, two men could make a simple shelter with their ponchos over their hole and be relatively, but not completely, dry on rainy nights. We could relax a little. I'm convinced we would have collapsed from the strain and exertion without such respites. But I found it more difficult to go back each time we squared away our gear to move forward into the zone of terror. My buddy's joking ceased as we trudged grim-faced back into the chasm where time had no meaning and one's chances of emerging unhurt dwindled with each encounter. With each step toward the distant rattle and rumble of that hellish region where fear and horror tortured us like a cat tormenting a mouse, I experienced greater and greater dread. And it wasn't just dread of death or pain, because most men felt somehow they wouldn't be killed. But each time we went up, I felt the sickening dread of fear itself and the revulsion at the ghastly scenes of pain and suffering among comrades that a survivor must witness. Some of my close friends told me they felt the same way. Significantly, those who felt it most acutely were the more battle-wise veterans from whom Okinawa was their third campaign. The bravest wearied of the suffering and waste, even though they showed little fear for their own personal safety. They simply had seen too much horror. The increasing dread of going back into action obsessed me. It became the subject of the most torturous and persistent of all the ghastly war nightmares that have haunted me for many, many years. The dream is always the same. Going back up to the lines during the bloody, muddy month of May on Okinawa. It remains blurred and vague, but occasionally still comes. Even after the nightmares about the shock and violence of Peleliu have faded and been lifted from me like a curse. The 7th Marines secured Dikeshi Ridge on 13 May after a bitter fight. Some of the Peleliu veterans in that regiment noted that the vicious battle resembled the fighting on Bloody Nose Ridge. We could see the ridge clearly. It certainly looked like Bloody Nose. The crest was rugged and jagged on the skyline, and had an ugly thin line of blackened, shattered trees and stumps. Our company moved into a smashed, ruined village that an officer told me was Dikeshi. Some of us moved up to a stout stone wall where we were ordered to hold our fire while we watched a strange scene about 100 yards to our front. We had to stand there inactive and watch as about 40 or 50 Japanese soldiers retreated through the ruins and rubble. They had been flushed by men of the 7th Marines, but we were in support of the 7th Marines, some elements of which were forward of us on the right and left, out of our field of vision. We couldn't risk firing for fear of hitting those Marines. We could only watch the enemy trotting along, holding their rifles. They wore no packs, only crossed shoulder straps, supporting their cartridge belts. As they moved through the rubble with helmets bobbing up and down, A man next to me fingered the safety catch on his M1 rifle and said in disgust, "Look at them bastards out there in the open. And we can't even fire at them." "Don't worry. The 7th Marines will catch them in a crossfire farther on," an NCO said. "That's the word," said an officer confidently. Just then, a swishing, rushing sound of shells passing low overhead made us all duck reflexively, even though we recognized the sound as our own artillery. Large, black, sausage-shaped clouds of thick smoke erupted in the air over the Japanese as each of those deadly 155-millimeter bursts exploded with a flash and a kerump. The artillery men were zeroed in on target. The Japanese broke into a dead run, looking very bow-legged to me, as they always did when running. Even as they ran away under that deadly hail of steel, showing us their backs, I felt there was an air of confident arrogance about them. They didn't move like men in panic. We knew they simply had been ordered to fall back to other strongly prepared defensive positions to prolong the campaign. Otherwise, they would have stayed put or attacked us, and in either case, fought to the death. More of our 155 swished over, erupting over the Japanese. We stood in silence and watched as the artillery fire took its toll on them. It was a grim sight, still vivid in my mind. The survivors moved out of sight through drifting smoke as we heard the rattle of Marine machine guns on our right and left front. We received orders to move out along a little road bordered by stone walls. We passed through the ruins of what had been a quaint village. What had been picturesque little homes with straw-thatched or tiled roofs were piles of smoldering rubble. After bitter fighting, the Awacha defenses and then those around Takeshi fell to our division. Yet between us and Shuri, there remained another system of heavy Japanese defenses. Wana. The costly battle against them would become known as the Battle for Wana Draw. Chapter 12 of Mud and Maggots.
The boundary between the 3rd Amphibious Corps, Marines, and the 24th Corps, Army, ran through the middle of the main Japanese defensive position on the heights of Shuri. As the Marines moved southward, the 1st Marine Division remained on the left in the 3rd Amphibious Corps' zone of action, with the 6th Marine Division on the right. Within the 1st Marine Division's zone of action, the 7th Marines occupied the left flank and the 5th Marines the right. The 1st Marines was in reserve. Beyond Awacha Takeshi, the Marines next faced Wana Ridge. On the other side of Wana Ridge lay Wana Draw, through which meandered the Asato Gawa. Forming the southern high ground above Wana Draw was yet another ridge, this one extending eastward from the city of Naha and rising to the Shuri Heights. This second ridge formed a part of the main Japanese defensive positions, the Shuri Line. Wana Draw aimed like an arrow from the northwest, directly into the heart of the Japanese defenses at Shuri. Within this natural avenue of approach, the Japanese took advantage of every difficult feature of terrain. It couldn't have provided a better opportunity for their defense if they had designed it. The longest and bloodiest ordeal of the Battle for Okinawa now faced the men of the 1st Marine Division. For the attack against Wana on the 15th of May, 1945, the 5th Marines sent 2-5 forward, with 3-5 in close support. The 1st Battalion came behind in reserve.
Before 2-5's attack began, we moved into a position behind that battalion. We watched tanks firing 75s and M7s firing 105s thoroughly shell the draw. The tanks received such heavy Japanese fire in return that the riflemen of 2-5 assigned to attack with the tanks had to seek any protection they could in ditches and holes while they covered the tanks from a distance. No man on his feet could have survived the hail of shells the enemy fired at the tanks. And the tanks couldn't move safely beyond the cover the riflemen provided because of Japanese suicide tank destroyer teams. Finally, We saw the tanks pull back after suffering some hits.